Tonight is the third night in this special series that we're doing, Nine Secrets of Satisfying Relationships. And so far in the series, we've looked at love the first week and joy last Sunday night. And tonight, I want to look at this subject of peace. And I would imagine that there are a few things that that we seek as much as we seek peace. When I was reading about the topic this week, I found that way back in ancient Greece, 2,500 years ago, the great teachers of Greece, they used to give public lectures on this topic, and huge crowds of people used to gather to hear this. How do you find peace? 2,500 years later, nothing much has changed. And particularly tonight, I want to look at it in this theme of how do we find peace in our relationships. Now, there's two ways initially that I want to talk about that are popular ways of finding peace, which actually don't help us find peace in our relationships at all. And they're here on the outline, which you would have received as you came in tonight, which we're now making available week by week, which you can use for notes or just follow where I've got to and how much longer I've got to go. One very popular way people think of finding peace in their relationships with others is just through avoiding problems. You know, I've got a real difficult relationship with you, so let's not just make waves. Let's avoid the problem. Let's not talk about it. I don't want to make waves. The problem is that someone has said that unresolved conflicts are to relationships what termites are to a house. And you know, if termites in the parts of the world where they have them get inside a house and eat away, eventually the house falls down. And if we have unresolved conflicts in our relationships with other people, there's something at the heart of the relationship, there's something rotten in there that's eating away, and eventually the relationship can turn very sour indeed. That's one approach. Another way that some people find finding relationships peace in their relationships with other people is simply through giving in. You know, particularly if I can't stand conflict, I will often seek to find peace in our relationship with each other simply by giving in to you all the time. Now, that keeps the peace, and you might think, well, I've achieved it. But in actual fact, what happens is that you end up dominating me. And you know what that does to me? It makes me feel resentful about you. And what actually happens is our stomach keeps the score. And while superficially the peace is established, inwardly this is doing bad things to me. And I resent the fact that every time there's a conflict, you win and I lose. And the ulcers begin to form in my stomach. My stomach actually keeps the score. Because the way God made us and the way we're wired up, life goes best when we resolve conflict and we live at genuine peace with other people. And tonight I want to talk about how do you do that. I doubt if there's any of us who do not want to live at peace in our relationships with other people. That isn't the problem. Not gaining intellectual assent on that. I mean, there'd be 100% of hands would go up if we said, who wants to live in peace with their relationships with other people? That isn't the problem. The problem is, how do you find it? Because it doesn't just happen. Peace doesn't just turn up if we give it long enough. If we're going to find peace in our relationships, we have to make it happen, and we have to become a peacemaker. And so that's what I want to talk about tonight, because the secret of finding peace in our relationships is to become a peacemaker. And that's the message tonight. That's what I want to talk about. Jesus talked about this, and he said this, that God blesses those people who make peace, and they will be called his children. Now, why did Jesus say that people who make peace are called God's children? What's so special about making peace? You know why Jesus said this? It's because that's what he does. That's what God does. God blesses those people who make peace. They'll be called God's children because what God does is make peace. And the whole of the Bible, and particularly the New Testament, the part that teaches about Jesus and his life and what followed, is the story of how God made peace with us. And what I want to do tonight is to take as a model, because it's all very well saying we ought to be peacemakers. I mean, that's great. But how do you actually do it? Now, if you look at what the message of the Bible is and how God has actually gone about making peace with humanity, it gives us a model of how we can go about finding peace in our relationships with other people. And so I've got 5 points. And the first one was the one that Clifford was talking to us so brilliantly. I'd love to be able to stand up here and do magic tricks, you know. People would stay awake much better than they do. Might get a few pointers afterwards. Point number one is to take the initiative, because this is what God did. And we read about this in the Apostle Paul. This is what he said. Even when we were God's enemies, he wrote, he made peace with us because his son died for us. Yet something even greater than friendship is ours. Now that we are at peace with God, we will be saved by his son's life. In addition to everything else, we are happy because God sent our Lord Jesus Christ to make peace with us. Now, what does all that mean? You know what it means? Is that we were enemies with God. Now, you might say, oh, I'm not an enemy with God. But all of us have separated ourselves from God. Now, this might be an act of hostility. I mean, you may feel really angry. I read a very interesting study a few months ago that said in the lives of most people who profess to be atheists, there is deep unresolved anger. Because people like that are not at peace with themselves, and they're not at peace with the world, they're not at peace with their relationships with others, and they're certainly not at peace with God. And so the reaction is just simply to deny God exists at all. Or you may just simply be indifferent. Couldn't care less. God, better things to do. And from God's perspective, we're his enemies. We're on the other side. And then he took the initiative. He sent his son, Jesus Christ, into this world to take the initiative to build a relationship back with us. Now, normally, when we're at odds with someone, we've fallen out with someone, and especially if it's their fault, what do? We think, well, well, I'll just wait. I'll sit here and wait for the phone to ring. They can ring and apologize, and I'll wait. Or I'll wait for the knock on the door or a letter of apology, but I'll wait for them to take the initiative. Now, the amazing thing, what the Bible says, is that God took the initiative. Now, most people I talk to who are not real followers of Jesus have the idea that if we're ever going to find God, the initiative lies completely with us. Somehow, if only I can be good enough, I can find acceptance with God. Doesn't work. God's taken the initiative. There's no way. The gulf is simply too big. Now, on the human level, when we have a fallout with someone, we wait for them to take the initiative. But Jesus said something really interesting about this. And this is what he said. Here's someone, they've gone along to church. You see, you're about to place your gift on the altar. And remember that someone is angry with you. Leave your gift there in front of the altar. Make peace with that person, then come back and offer your gift to God. You hear what he's saying? This is real important. That's the first thing he's saying. The second thing he's saying is really interesting. He says, here you are, you've come to worship, you see, like we have tonight, and you're going to make a gift to God. Well, that's a very good thing to do. And then you remember that you're angry with someone, so you better do something about it. But that isn't what he says. He says, you remember that someone is angry with you. In other words, what Jesus is saying, it actually doesn't matter. And this is really the challenging thing. If you want to be a peacemaker, it isn't just where you've wronged someone. You think, well, boy, I really did something. I really hurt that person. I better go and apologize. It's if we ourselves have been hurt. That's what he's saying. And this, he says, this is incredibly important. This is more important, he says, at that moment, this is more important than worshiping God. Because you can't worship God properly if you're all stewed up inside and you've fallen out of relationships with people. You can't do it. You can stand there thinking, oh God, how I love you and all this stuff, and it's false. Because inside you're all churned up and stirred up because someone you know, someone out there, and they're really mad at you. Really mad. So what he says, get up and go. I won't do this right at the moment, else I'll be left here talking to an empty hall, I suppose. This is incredibly important. This is what he's saying. You go out there, you get reconciled to that person. Then you can really worship God from your heart because it will be genuine. Well, that's real interesting, isn't it? I mean, you know, most often, I think, when I think back on my experience, if someone's wronged me, I feel quite good about it, really. I mean, I think, and I get a few friends around and I say, hey, that wasn't my fault, was it? No, they say, no, that wasn't your fault. They're real bad. You've been really wronged here. That digs me further into the trench, you know. I think, well, I'm not such a bad fella after all, and you know, that's their problem, and they've got to sort it out. What can I do? You want to be a peacemaker? Real challenging stuff. Yeah. I remember, you know, a very vivid example of peacemaking was in 1979. Some of us are older enough to remember that, some of us are not. But in 1979, Anwar Sadat, who was then the president of Egypt, and for as long as anyone can remember, Israel and Egypt have been in conflict. And he made a famous speech in which he said, I am prepared to go to Israel, stand in the Israeli parliament, the Knesset. I am prepared to do that in the face of our enemies and plead for peace. And he did. And he showed up. He got off the plane in Israel. And he went to the Knesset and he stood there and he pleaded for peace. And you know, the outcome of that amazingly brave and bold step of initiative was the beginning of the peace process when Jimmy Carter and Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat got together and put in place a peace process which amazingly, in spite of all the hostility and the bombings and everything else, is still actually in place. One brave person who took a step of initiative. Now, if you do this, you won't necessarily be very popular, and Anwar Sadat, of course, is no longer with us. Dead, killed through an assassin's bullet from someone who had no interest in peace. He's a peacemaker. And Jesus said, people who act like that, they're children of God. Because that's what God's about. If you want to behave like God behaves, take some initiatives in peacemaking. Now, you've got to set up a time to talk. You know, and you've got to choose your moment. You know, here you are and you've got a relationship with someone and it's fallen out and it's bad. Think about it. What are you going to do? You're going to take a step, an initiative. How are you going to do it? Are you just going to blurt out to them the first thing? It's worth thinking about how to go about it. I mean, particularly if it's a husband and wife, choose your moment. Right? Not when you're just dropping off to sleep, or your husband or your wife, your partner's just dropping off to sleep and you're lying there in turmoil over this thing and they're just falling off to sleep and you say, hey, there's a big issue I've really got to talk to you about. You know, the wrong moment, you know, doesn't go down very well. Choose your moment. But the first step to peacemaking is doing what God did. He took the initiative. Now the second step is to acknowledge our failure. If you wind back to that Romans passage, we were actually God's enemies. And if we individually are going to find peace with God, we've got to face the truth. I've gone my own way in life, God's over here and I'm over here, and I'm living my life in a different direction than God intends me for my life. There can be no reconciliation with God until I face up to my failures in my life. Can't happen. And there can be no reconciliation among two humans unless we are prepared to face up to our fault and the breakdown of the relationship. It is very, very rare that in a relationship breakdown that there is one totally innocent party. Now, it does sometimes occur, but it's very, very rare. And that's what makes reconciliation so difficult, is that for reconciliation to occur, I have to acknowledge my part in the breakdown of the relationship. And everyone feels it's the other person's fault. You know, if we'd both reacted in this situation like I did, then this relationship would be great. But we all know what a difficult person that other person is that my relationship's broken down with. And everyone tells me what a difficult person they are. Reconciliation's so difficult because it's so difficult to acknowledge our failure in a relationship. There's an author who writes a lot of books about marriage named Walter Trobisch. And he was asked one day, would he remarry a divorced person? And he said, yes. He said, I only marry. Yes, he said, I would. But, he said, I will only remarry the guilty party. And someone said to him, what? What do you mean? Surely, if someone has been guilty of breaking down the marriage, on what grounds do you remarry them? And he said, well, it's no use marrying someone who's protesting their innocence, because out of the failure of their marriage, they've learned absolutely nothing. But if someone, he said, can face up to the fact that their marriage has failed and accept the responsibility that they shoulder for the breakdown of the marriage, then he said, out of this, they've learned something, and maybe that gives them ground to hope. Now, our failure in the breakdown of a relationship may simply have been our failure to listen and to understand. I don't think our society actually presents us with very good models of this. I was thinking of this week when I was watching a well-known current affairs program, which comes just after One Network News. And there's an aggressive belligerence in this, that characterizes this program. And this is set before us each night as a model, I presume, of how to deal with contentious issues. And so poor hapless individuals are brought into the studio and the professional interviewer turns loose on them. And you watch his style. He invites someone to start talking, and as soon as they start talking, he shouts them down. What about this? And you're not doing kind of stuff. And so it's modeled to us. This is actually how you deal with difficult issues. I just wait till you get started saying your little piece, then I shout you down. Holmes never loses. You notice that? He never loses. Because even if the other person does win, eventually the camera comes back onto him and he has a raised eyebrow or a smirk and he's won. He never loses. I would never go on that show. I don't know why people agree to go on it. I had a friend who went on it just recently. I said, why did you go on it? And Holmes made mincemeat of him. I said, why did you go? He said, I don't know. I don't know why I did it. Never do it again. And this is modeled to us by our political leaders in New Zealand. I mean, look at the way they talk to each other. It's shameful. Someone is trying to make a point, and the other one simply shouts them down. And we are not having good models put in front of us in our society today on how to work for conflict resolution, how to solve problems. Because that, I mean, in case you hadn't guessed, that's actually not how you work for reconciliation. You don't wait till the person you've got a difference with just starts to state their case and then you shout them down, you're wrong! Your problem is you won't listen to me! Yeah, just a little clue, that doesn't actually work. You know, and people feel embittered and pained by this experience. Doesn't work. The second point is that you have to acknowledge your own failure. You know, listening and trying to understand people is real hard work. It's real hard work. But I came across a saying this week which I found I'd never heard it before. But it's very helpful. And the saying is this, that hurt people hurt people. If there's someone going around and in their relationships they're hurting people, that's a clear indication that they are hurt. And if someone has hurt you, it's because undoubtedly they are hurt. But it's real hard. You know, if someone's laying into you, and they're saying stuff that you're finding really hurtful, to sit there in a dispassionate Christian way, godly sort of thoughts flooding your mind, and saying, this person has been hurt, that's why they're hurting me. I must confess at this point that that's not my initial response. Normally, when someone says stuff to me that's hurtful, everything within me rises up. And I think they're liars. They're hurtful. It's real hard, I think, to think, hey, why is this person? Especially if there's a pattern in people's relationships, because if someone's hurting one person, they're going to hurt other people too. And that tends to be a repeating pattern. And this is why reconciliation is such a hard, hard thing, but this is so important. If there's been a relationship breakdown, I'm not perfect. What's hurting this person that's causing them to hurt me? You know, my natural reaction is to get angry, but if we can hang in there and we can listen and we can try and understand and we can resolve the conflict, we're going to come out of this with a far greater understanding of this other person, and they will have an understanding of us, than if the conflict had never happened. And that's why real good can actually come out of conflict, because, you know, the whole Christian gospel, the whole message of the good news of Jesus came out of the conflict between God and ourselves, and this wonderful good news came out of it through God's act of initiative taking. So that's the second point. The third step that we see in God's action for us and in taking, it's over the page now here, in working for our own reconciliation is to speak the truth in love. Here it is. Love should always make us tell the truth. Then we will grow in every way and be more like Christ, the head of the body. Two things. If we're going to find effective resolution with people with our difficulties, there are two things. The first one is that we have to speak the truth. It's real hard. I mean, like I was saying at the start there, it's much easier just to avoid problems or just to give in. Speaking the truth is hard and it can be very painful. But unless we do speak the truth about a relationship that's gone bad, we will never resolve it. The second thing, though, is that we have to speak the truth in love. Because if I don't speak the truth in love, if I just speak the truth, the situation will be worse than it was before. That's why reconciliation is so hard. But remember, those who are peacemakers are doing the work of God. That's God's intention for us. And we find fulfillment, deep satisfaction in our lives when we are doing what Jesus told us we ought to be doing. We can only make matters worse if we don't speak the truth in love. We are never persuasive, it's been said. We are never persuasive when we're abrasive. It's very profound. I came across these seven rules for fighting fear from Rick Warren in Southern California. He was actually talking about a marriage resolution, but I thought these are very good points, so I've outlined them there on the outline that you've got. These seven secrets, or now what does he call them? Seven rules for fighting fear. Seven nevers, if you want to speak the truth in love. Number one is never compare. Never say, why can't you be more like Bruce? You know, what a loving, caring man he is. Look at the way he relates to Mary. Why can't you relate to me like that? Or, you're just like your mother. Which I've noticed is never spoken in an improving way. And never condemn. It's not very helpful to say you should be ashamed of yourself. Yeah, it's all your fault. Whenever, it's a helpful thing probably to think that whenever we start a sentence with you, in this kind of context, it's mostly condemnation that we're about to heap onto someone. It's helpful to back up and think, is there some other way of saying this? You know, hey, we've got a problem here. Or it seems to me. that whatever it is. Or, you know, I feel real pain by what's been going on. Can we talk about it? And at this point, our primary response to the other person is not one of condemnation, but it's one working for some kind of reconciliation. Number three is never command. Never end an argument by force. I demand that you listen to what I'm saying. Oh? No. The person's an adult, you know, so you ought to treat him like an adult, not like a little child. Number four, never challenge. Don't threaten people. You just try that. You just try it and see what'll happen. It's been said that we most often in a marriage situation, this is used in terms of money, sex, and divorce. You just try that. And you see what I'll do. Terrible. Never, ever do that. It doesn't work for reconciliation. Never challenge. And never condescend or ridicule people or belittle them or play the amateur psychologist. That's very common. You know. I know. Do you want to know why you're doing that? I mean, face it. I can't understand my own motivations most of the time. And my own motives, let alone pretending that I can understand other people's. So that's don't condescend and never contradict. You know, so I was talking about the talk show host, to interrupt people, contradict them. As they're trying to say something, you butt in and don't let them say their piece. And never confuse. That's when you bring in other stuff, you know. You remember what your father did 5 years ago and you've never gone over that and it comes up in every, you know, this kind of thing. Nothing to do with the present argument, so leave it out. Speak the truth in love. And the fourth point, that what we see is that God, having done this amazing act of reconciling us, he calls us to walk in peace together, and this affects our own relationships as well. Paul again says this, do your best to live at peace with everyone. Do your best to live at peace with everyone. Do your best to live at peace with everyone. It's a bit of a tall order, isn't it? To walk in peace with people. To do this, if you're in a strained relationship with people, and in order to do this, basically you've got to try and find common ground where there's real difficulties, if you're going to be able to walk in peace together. And you need to learn to be flexible. A great deal of relational conflict and breakdown is caused because people are inflexible. It's been said that more marriages die from inflexibility than from adultery, alcohol, or abuse. Interesting. Most often, you know, these days marriages fail and people say, well, we're just, you know, we're not compatible. I came across this quotation from Paul Tournier, who's a Swiss psychiatrist, greatly respected Swiss psychiatrist. He said this, so-called compatibility is a myth invented by jurists in order to plead for divorce. It is just a common excuse people use to hide their own failings. Misunderstandings and mistakes can be corrected when there is a willingness to do so. The problem is a lack of complete frankness. I found that fascinating. And another man named Paul Popineau, who's the director of the Institute of Family Relations in the US, what he says, I don't believe incompatibility exists. Almost any two people are compatible if they try to be. If those two guys are right, that blows most of our contemporary understanding of marriage right out of the water. Are we just incompatible? What they're saying is there's no such thing. It's just you're not prepared to work hard enough. Now, there are other reasons why marriages break down. There's nothing to do with incompatibility. They're for genuine reasons. But this one is, this is the cure-all. Now, this is often, well, not the cure-all, the excuse-all for the thing breaking down. See, the whole deal about walking in peace together is that none of us are ever going to get our way in everything all the time. we can walk hand in hand, someone has said, without seeing eye to eye. That's actually quite profound. Well, I thought it was quite profound when you think about it. You can walk hand in hand without seeing eye to eye. No two people are ever going to agree on everything. I mean, that's how it is. And reconciliation doesn't mean that everyone sees eye to eye on everything. But it does mean that we walk hand in hand. But actually, you can't see eye to eye and walk hand in hand exactly at the same time either. I've been sitting musing on that saying all week, but it's a bit deep. Number five, and this I want to end. If we're going to find real reconciliation with other people, if we're going to be peacemakers, first of all, we have to find peace with God. And this is the Apostle Paul again. Put up with each other and forgive anyone who does you wrong, just as Christ has forgiven you. Love is more important than anything else. It is what ties everything completely together. Each one of you is part of the body of Christ, and you were chosen to live together in peace. So let the peace that comes from Christ control your thoughts and be grateful. If you want to be a peacemaker, if you want to discover the secret of having peace in your relationships with other people and of being a peacemaker, this is where you begin. I don't know any other place you can begin, but you become a follower of Christ. You commit your life to Him. And His life, His peace, begins to invade your life. And people who have been following Christ for a long time will tell you they've made an amazing experience, that a sense of peace grows in their life the more they commit themselves to being a follower of Jesus. Now, you can't have peace of mind if you have conflict in your spirit. If you could imagine a toothpaste tube, I mean, if when the squeeze comes on a toothpaste tube, whatever's in the toothpaste tube comes out. Now, whether it's toothpaste or whether it's whatever, out it comes. And you know, when the squeeze comes on us in life, whatever's inside comes out. And if your life is filled with resentment and anger, you may be able to bluff people for a fair bit of the time. But when the squeeze comes on and you get into real difficult situations, whatever in there is going to come spilling out. And I have seen that in people. Over years, I've seen vivid examples of this. The people, you know, who fooled other people. You think, oh, they've got life squared away, and then the squeeze comes on and all sorts of stuff comes out. And you think, where's all that come from? But if you have let the peace of Christ dwell in your heart, if you've let God's peace come into your heart and you've grown in that peace, when the squeeze comes on, you know what's going to come out? The peace of God. And this is going to overflow to other people. This is not an easy thing. This whole deal about finding peace in our relationships, hey, this is not an easy thing. Who doesn't want it? But this is I find this a very challenging thing. Because to be a peacemaker, be an initiative taker and work for reconciliation, that is hard work. And some people who try it end up dead. And this is hard too, to really know the peace. Now everyone, I'd like the peace of Jesus in my heart. Oh yeah, sure. It'd be wonderful. But this is a lifelong journey where we start and we're to grow in this peace, so that as we grow and progress through our lives, the peace of Christ forms in our life more and more and more. So when you get real old, you're going around and you're just exuding the stuff. And, you know, I've met people like that. You know, what a joy it is to be around them. They're at peace with themselves and they're at peace with other people. They're at peace with the world. And they're at peace with God. And just being with them is such an encouraging experience. I've met others who've reached the end of the road and it's been a little bit different. And what's forming in your life? When the squeeze comes on, what comes out? What comes out? You know, if you ask the question, how do you make peace with God? I've been thinking about this. I think that a lot of people think it's like making a truce. You know, okay, I'll give up fighting God, but he can stay over there and I'll stay over here. You know, sometimes when there's been a war, they make a truce. At the end of the First World War, they made a truce. And the Germans stayed over here, and the Allies stayed over here, and we drew a line down the map, and we said there'll be a truce. And the Allies heaped on the Germans all this stuff they had to pay for the war. It didn't work. It really didn't work. In fact, it was a disaster. And it led to the Second World War, which was so much worse than the First World War. But the Second World War, they'd learned the lesson. And they asked of the Nazis one thing. There would be no truce this time around. As far as the Nazis were concerned, no truce. One thing. Only one thing. And that's unconditional surrender. So when the war came, when the end came, the Nazis had to make an unconditional surrender. And then a democratic government is established in Germany, and the Allies poured in a phenomenal amount of money. The complete reverse to the end of the First World War, and it worked. And now it is inconceivable that in Western Europe there would be a war. There's two ways to find peace. One is, let's just make a truce. Let's call it quits, and God can stay over here, and we'll stay here, and God, you keep your distance, you stay over here, and we'll stay over here. It doesn't work. The only way you find peace is through unconditional surrender, where you say to God, God, I've kept you at a distance, and now this hasn't really worked for me. Now I want a new beginning in my life, and God, I will unconditionally surrender my life to you. And in that way, you find real peace. A few days ago, I was talking to a fellow, and he was telling me how he'd become a Christian a few years ago, and he said the thing that he found the scariest thing and becoming a Christian, becoming a follower of Jesus, he said the thing that he found the scariest of all was the fact that he was no longer in control of his life. He said, up to that point in my life, I prided myself that I was in control of my life, even though he said I'd made a fair mess of my life, he said I was in control of it. But now he said I committed my life to Christ, and he said I knew he was in control of my life, and he said that was such a scary experience. But now he said, I've come to find that it is such a positive experience and such a great experience, he said. And what I first found as such a scary experience, now, he said, is the most important thing to me in life. You want to find peace with God? There's only one way. Not through making a truce and thinking, God, you stay over here and I'll stay there. That may be a human way of making peace, but God's way, hey, you come. You surrender yourself to me unconditionally. I'll give you my peace in your heart. You stop fighting me. The only way we really find the peace of God deep in our hearts is when we stop fighting him. If you want to be a peacemaker, then stop fighting God. What are you holding out on in your life? What are you holding out against God for? I mean, it doesn't work. It makes us miserable inside. And whatever it is, in as much as we're holding out stuff from God, that means we can't fulfill God's purpose for ourselves, which is for all of us to make peace in this world, that the world may get a little glimpse of what the kingdom of God is all about. Let's bow our heads in prayer. We're just going to be quiet for a moment. I'd just like to invite you just for a moment to reflect on your life. Would other people look at you and think, thank God for this person, they're a peacemaker? Or are you a troubler of the peace? And if you know in your heart you're not, why don't you take the time to say to God, God, I'm sorry that I'm not a peacemaker. Help me to be one. Even though it's painful and it's hard, help me to be one. And do you have, the second question is, do I have God's peace in my heart? And if you don't, ask God. God, I'm sorry, living my life just my own way, and it hasn't brought me your peace in my heart, and I want it, Lord. Help me to unconditionally surrender my life to you. That I might find your peace. For I ask it in the name of Jesus. Amen.